Did you plan those images beforehand, or did they come spontaneously?
They came pretty much spontaneously. I mean, I had an idea for what I wanted to do, which I'll explain. The images are based upon the poem Prithayanavan. This particular images that came just came. But the plan bit was a descent through the layers of the poem Prithayanavan, which is in itself a condensation of Brythonic tradition. So what I'm doing there is a condensation of a condensation. So the images are the images that appeared to me in the moment, as we moved through the layers of Prithayanavan.
Okay, great.
So the very first image, really, that was looking into darkness, into a kind of a shining darkness, which then becomes filled with many colours, which then becomes very elaborate Celtic strapwork with Celtic knotwork, interlace work, within which all kinds of forms are seen: wizards, gods, demons, goddesses, monstrous figures, beautiful figures, really the whole kind of mystery of the uncoiling kind of tradition. Then the next image was of a conjunction of a golden and white spiral and a briar rose with petals and thorns. And then the next image was the white chapel with the hallows, with a sort of a golden, there was like a golden crescent. There's a sword and a sword, a spear and a stone. Then there was the dark place with a fire surrounded by the stars. Then there was the image of looking into the deep and seeing the dead. Then there was the image of the wall and the warrior in bronze armour who does not speak. Then there...
Pātapale with the sentence.
Yeah, that's right. And then there is the door with the golden ox's head and the green and silver bear. And then finally there is the white doe leading us into the mound and the awakening of the sleeper. Now, the thing about that meditation, like all these very swift meditations, is they're seed meditations. So whatever you had, or even if you think you didn't have anything, there is a something seeded in you there that you can return to, but that is particular to your experience. So the intention of that whole exercise is to tap into the roots of the Arthurian kind of tradition. And in a sense, we're going long before any of the later medieval stories. We're looking right back at this very early poem called Prithayanavan, which is the very earliest quest for the Grail, which also, and in that poem also has within it the search for that which regenerates, and also the freeing of the prisoner. So the intention of Prithayanavan, that which is said to have been written by Taliesin himself, is that it is a highly condensed, very like Christopher Iqbal's poem, very, very condensed introduction to the roots of early Welsh tradition. And so these very strange, I mean, these strange images, there's lots more strange images in the poem itself, in fact, are doorways and mysterious possibilities that can emerge in us if we pay attention to them. Because to come back to the subject we were looking at before lunch, as we become present, as we become, if you like, very much ourselves, very connected, very present, we of course are connected to the world around us. And in particular, we're connected to the deep currents of that world, the deep shaping. And just as Christopher Vickbro connects to the roots of his home village, the roots of Yoruba tradition, and finds a way to create or manifest a new form of that, that's something we all need to do. And we don't have to necessarily study Welsh myth or anything like that, but it is about being present with our sense of self, our sense of history, our sense of ancestry, and our sense of place. Now, you don't have to, nobody has to study Welsh stories, but if we're looking at the shaping of this country, if we're looking at the shaping of the collective unconscious of this country, the Welsh and Saxon myths, Norman French myths, Christian myths that apply to this country are part of the shaping and part of what forms our current sense of who we are and how we should be in the world collectively as well as individually. So if you were to think for a moment about the collective British soul, and if I just for a moment think about how that has shifted during my lifetime, I was thinking over lunch that sense of really when I was growing up in the 50s, it was the British soul was very specifically English, with some add-ons like the Welsh and the Scots and the Irish. But a very solid sense of Englishness, and a very solid sense of the primacy of Englishness, and of Englishness being the centre pole. And the one of the things that has happened in my life is the sense now of the nations of the United Kingdom. Now that really wasn't around that much in my childhood. You know, the idea of the very idea that there would be, I feel like, national parliaments would have seemed ludicrous. You know, there wasn't even on the cards. You know, so there is a shift in the direction of more differentiation. But we're all haunted, whatever our nation, whatever our nationality, whatever ethnicity you identify by the shadows of empire. We're haunted by and therefore by the imperial class system that was necessary in order for the empire to function. And this sense of kind of the supremacy of the white person, of the white Britisher, who can say Civis Britannicus sum, is still active in the national psyche. You know, and that very complex layering of class and ethnicity and money and history, you know, creates a very very dense and quite difficult form somewhere.
And male and patriarchy.
Male and patriarchy obviously is underlies it, because that's even older, right? So that's much older. So that's also what goes on underneath. So part of the reason sometimes we're really looking into some of these very much older traditions is that we find different models of possibility that have become occluded in the life of the nation, in the life of the culture. You know, it's one of the things that when you go back to whether it's a Welsh poetry or the writings of somebody like Christopher Okigbo, what you find is a very profound non-linearity and a juxtaposition of opposites that enables new possibilities to arise. Now, when we look at things like Taliesin's poetry, it's never easy. You know, it's a sort of, what's that about? You know, it's a bit irritating. What's that about? What are these strange images about? What's this business of ox heads and green and silver bears? Or what's a Whitechapel got to do with anything? And in a way, the point of these images, which hold intentionality, which hold purpose, but they come from a different way of thinking, a different way of understanding, which is, and therefore they wake up the possibility of that different way of being within us. And that different way of being is deeply linked to this territory of the tree that we're looking at, because we're looking at the conjunction of opposites, opposites in union, as opposed to opposites at war.
Yeah.
And one of the things that, in that sequence of images, that kind of sense of blackness and the profusion of bright colour, and then this kind of, almost archetypally Celtic image of knotwork. Now, the interesting thing about Celtic knotwork is when you see any of the great Celtic knotwork pieces, all kinds of shapes arise out of the knotwork, and yet it's one flow. It's one connected thing. So out of that one connected flowing thing, all kinds of different forms arise. And so in that sense, it's an image both of the deepest parts of ourselves and of the universe. So the shapes of horror, shapes of beauty, all connected by the same swirling, knotted, turning back on itself line. There is no, in knotwork, there's no straight. There's no the straightness is illusory, because it's not a progression, because it keeps on. In order for knotwork to work, it has to keep on coiling back on itself. And one of the other images that therefore is central to that is the image of the spiral. So we're not looking at linearity, we are looking at progress, but we're looking at spiral progress, where things get recapitulated in new ways, and where there's a constant moving line and interplay between the line and the space around the line. And in the second image, the other image that came up really is the image of the rose with its petals and its thorns. And as the meditation progresses, in the next bit of the meditation, we find ourselves in this strange thing called a white chapel, with these objects: a golden crescent, a sword, a spear, and a stone. These are the classic Grail Hallows, and it's like being in a little Grail chapel. But actually, if we just, in a way, strip away the kind of knowing a bit, and we're with this kind of the gold crescent, a spear, a sword, and a stone, and just can be with that nakedly in this strange place called the White Chapel, maybe then something else happens. And then we move. If we move from that then to this place gathered around a dark place and a fire. So light and darkness, and then we are surrounded by stars. And then the next thing, completely different scene, looking deep into the sea, into the blue-greenness of the sea, contemplating the dead. Then the next iteration, we're up against the wall with a bronze, ancient bronze-clad warrior who will not speak. So again, there's an, in both this having feel like being in the rather, you know, what might feel the secure and the beautiful surroundings of the white chapel, and then being around a fire at night, we're suddenly in more disturbing places. We're looking into the deeps of the sea, seeing the ranks of the dead. We're suddenly confronted by an ancient bronze warrior who will not talk to us and will not let us pass. And then we're before this mysterious door with a golden ox's head and a green and silver bear. And then we're in the mound with the led by a white doe to a place where an ancient sleeper wearing a gold mask awakes. Now the sequence, you know, broadly, this the first place of the interlace is Kaiv City. Kaiv Pedevran is the place of the spiral. Kaiv Vedwit is the place of the White Chapel. Kaiv Ego, the place of the fire and the darkness and the stars. Kaiv Widri is the place of the looking into the deep sea. Kaiv Golith is the place of the wall. Kaiv Vandwi is the place of the ox's head and the bear. And Kaiv Ochren is the place of the mound and the sleeper. But those are just images that appeared to be the many other possible ways of understanding and describing the stages of Prithayanavan. And the point of the images is that they often don't make sense, and they're intended not to make sense. They're coming from something deeper. So the intention, in a sense, really is to hang out with them, see what they talk to them, and let them talk back.
Ask a question while you're in your flow.
No, go ahead, ask a question.
So I'm just wondering, there's relevance to the path. Is there some link to this path from Tipperary to Quetta of this journey?
Well, it's not a linear thing, but this particular path is all about the capacity to bridge between duality and non-duality. So the particular intention of Prithayanavan is to connect to that mysterious place that regenerates everything, that is the deep root of our spirit. It also has the intention to free that which imprisons us. So again, there's a very profound, not an obvious link perhaps, but a very profound link between the way of being that arises in us as we work this path, and the way of being that is expressed in the poem and in those images. Because in order to, if you think of just following that, even just that particular sequence of images, then there could be many others, where there's something about trusting the unfolding mystery that moves you from one place to another. So it begins, in a sense, with this image of the profound interconnectedness of everything. And then we're given this image of the spiral and the rose with the petals and the thorns. And then we're taken into the experience of the hallows. Now the hallows are not comfortable things. So there is a sword, there is a spear, there is a stone, there is a strange thing, a golden crescent that may be the grail, or maybe something else. So there are these strange kinds of images that are archaic images. That all of which, and all the hallows of the Grail, have the potential to change and regenerate things. If people are interested in the story of the Hallows, there's a wonderful novel by Alan Garner called Elidor, where there's an opening between the inner world and the outer world, and some kids in a bombed out bit of Manchester discover the Hallows of the Grail, but they present themselves in this world. So the stone is an old bit of brick, the spear is a metal railing, the Grail is a china cup, and the sword is a wooden sword formed of two laths nailed together. And Elidor is a really powerful. In fact, draw on some of the. It's quite explicit on some of the images of Prithianovin and Elidor. So that's a very. It's a good read for one thing, but it kind of takes us into this rather mysterious thing that anything can be the Grail, anything can be the Hallow, if it's attuned to the deeper archetype. And in a way, that's the point of, if we look at this particular path and look at this connection really between the deep root of everything, the non-dual root where everything is in profound relationship, then we start to see everything talking to everything else. So we start to discover we're in a living world where each thing connects to everything else and talks to itself and talks to each other. And the question is, do we enter into the dialogue or not? You know, and if we move beyond the place of the Hallows, we come then to this mysterious place, which is this is Kyrigo, the place of the royal feast. Again, the place where there's opposite, where there's the light of the fire and there is darkness. And you're sitting on the earth inside somewhere and sitting amongst the stars. So again, the conjunction of opposites. And then that's followed really by a little sequence that's really about going into the deep place, Kaivudri, looking deeply into the ancestral pool, looking into the place of the dead. It also then moves on to looking at obstacles and that which will not talk to us and will not let us pass. And what do we do with that? And then we're given this much more kind of much higher, deeper place, this ancient image of the ox, this archaic image of the ox, who in a certain sense is the ox that turns the universe. This is the image of the ox who turns the plough of the stars, turns the great, who is also the seven stars of the great bear. So this conjunction of the ox and the bear and it gives us that sense of the motive energy behind the whole of the universe. And then finally we come to this place of the Kairochren, the castle of the keys, where we're taken into something that is asleep and now wakes up. And what happens then? What happens when the sleeper wakes? Now this comes from one of the earliest stratas of Welsh myth, because where this, if you like, the whole Arthurian kind of thing begins in poetry. It begins in the poems from the Book of Taliesin, the poems from the Black Book of Carmarthen. This is where we discover the beginnings of people like Arthur and Taliesin and Myrddin. And this is the start of something. And of course, we don't have access to the originals. What we have these are all medieval poems. So if we want to go further back, we have to go back to the kind of territory really that Marcus is pointing to in Orkney, to the image of the wife of what was it called, Marcus?
Westry.
White of Westry, that's it. That's it. Yeah.
There's a very similar one from Scarabray. I'll see if I can find it in the break. Show you that one.
Lovely, yeah. Because that's where we come. So we come to the deepest layers. That's where we come to. And in fact, when I do the next course, I'm going to be looking at that archaeological layer. Because we always tend to start with the medieval stuff, because that's the earliest, our earliest written sources. But actually, before that, there are some of these very early layers, which we only find in fragmentary images normally. But those fragmentary images are worth listening to and worth talking to. And in a certain sense, and even then, because actually, if we look at things like, if you look at people like Lindo Man, which we think of as very, this is the peat bog figure found in Lindo Moss, who very likely was a druidic sacrifice, a ritual, he dies the ritual threefold death, probably in order to offset the Roman advance upon the Britons at that time. So we think of Lindo Man as very ancient, but of course he is Roman. He's in the post-Roman period. He's not Roman, he's Celtic, but he's in the Roman period. So he, again, is much later on than the earlier stuff, which is the Halstead and Latin culture that we really see in artifacts, but have, again, no written evidence of. Now, one of the interesting things about the early Welsh poems and about the Mabinogi and all of that is they retain some of the images. They retain their archaicness because they retain that kind of early storytelling form, which in some ways is very conservative. But and the point I think about looking back into the past like this, partly we might do it just because we're in a really historical cast of minds, so I quite enjoy doing that. But also it's because these are subtle layers of shaping within the collective imagination. And some of them, a lot of them, kind of get lost, and what gets remembered is whatever is useful at the time and whatever is needed by the culture to progress its goals and aims. But when we're at a time like we are now, a time of cultural cul-de-sac, I would say, and we're in quite extreme, very extreme circumstances, we need some of these qualities that have been lost in order to meet the particular challenges of the time. And in a certain sense, if we look at some of the beginnings of the Arthurian myth and we look at people like St. Illtyd, the Arthurian myth, as far as we can judge, gets really galvanized in this kind of post-Roman period. Because what seems to happen is that there's this whole period with Rome and the Celts and battle and all kinds of horrible things happen on both sides, in fact. And then a culture forms that is predominantly Roman, but also also influenced by the British culture that's there. So you get this kind of Romano-British culture forming itself, and which becomes stable for some hundreds of years. So, and I mean, in a way, that's part of history that we kind of forget about when we think, for about 300 years, this was a stable culture. Now, and the great span of things, it doesn't feel very long. But actually, if you really think of what 300 years involves, it would take, it would take us back to 1723. So, by the time something's been in existence 300 years, it feels like it's been there forever. It doesn't feel ephemeral, it feels like this is the way the world is. So the breakdown of that world, which is what happens when the legions are withdrawn and as Rome starts to fall apart, and the incursion of the Jutes and the Saxons and the raidings along the east coast and then the invasions, really is the break, like an apocalypse. Is an apocalypse. It is a breaking down of a kind of a known world. And what emerges out of this is this image, which will be Christian as much as pagan, the image of a saviour figure who will enable the Britons to return to their ancient dignity. Because what happens, you know, the reason that the Celts are all in the edges of the island mostly, is because they got driven out, you know. So Cornwall, Wales, Scotland, parts of the western side of Northumbria and Lancashire. These are where they end up, because actually what happens is an invading people, in all cases really, takes the best land for itself. And the invasion is from the east. If it had been from Ireland, it would have gone the other direction. In fact, there's aspects of North Wales that are very Irish because of the down in the Clean Peninsula because of the Irish invasion, actually. But of course, it was not as extensive as the Saxon. So what happens is that the culture, in fact, even the name Welsh is comes from Welais, the Anglo-Saxon word for the foreigner or the stranger. And one just interesting tidbit is, if any town you come to that has a district called Walcott in it, and many towns do, Walcott is the Welsh ghetto. It's where the Welsh were kept. So the Welsh who didn't go, that stayed in the community, were sort of herded into their Welsh ghetto.
There's a big street in Bath called Walcott Street.
There's a whole area in Swindon called Walcott. There are quite a lot of places have the name Walcott, and it's very old. It's just the place where the Welsh used to live. Okay. So what we see happening out of that time is the need for a kind of a saviour figure. There's a very ancient Welsh Brittonic traditions about this, but also of course the idea of the saviour, the Messiah figure, is strong in Christian tradition, and we have to remember the time of the breakup of the Romano British Society. It's very Christian. And it's the kind of Christianity that's in a lot of dialogue with the older traditions. Much in a way that you find Christopher Okigbo looking at the fusion of pagan Yoruba tradition with Christian tradition. But within that, there is the sense of the Messiah figure who will restore justice and so we get this figure of the Mab Duragon, the son of destiny, who becomes the kind of Welsh Messiah figure, who is associated with the particular figure we get in Prydain of him called Cheminac the Leaper. Because the Mab Duragon, there's another figure in the Mabinogi called Gorai, son of Custennin. Gorai means the best boy, the one who is the best. And the qualities of the Mab Duragon, the quality of the Cheminac and Gorai, is they can leap over obstacles and free prisoners. So there is a sense of collective imprisonment and the desire for a saviour figure that then attaches itself to some very old kind of Welsh myths. Now the root of the name Arthur is the old Welsh word Arth or Ath, which means bear. And the bear is in this older tradition is the protector of the tree of life, and the servant of the mother, servant of the deep mother, and sometimes called the cub of the great mother bear. Right. So if you like, there is a whole kind of very early tradition of that's existent in Welsh tradition, of this, of these guardian figures that protect them, that protect the tree of life, that protect the integrity of life, that keep things, that keep the world in balance. Very like the Egyptian word Ma'at. They maintain the balance of the world. And so out of this need from the, as the, from the, you know, the destruction of Romano British culture, you know, and the thing about the whole thing about Romano British culture is it was very civilized, very settled, very established. And what you see, and so the reason we discover hoards of treasure from time to time, is that world is then completely falls apart, the cities fall apart. That's why places like Bath become completely deserted, because they don't work anymore. Because they, so you find that the whole infrastructure, so we have to imagine, if you're thinking of it from our point of view here, imagine the supply chain breaking down completely. Right, so you can't get food from shops anymore. So money becomes useless because nobody recognizes it anymore, because you can't buy anything. So what you have to do is to find places, retreat to places where you can grow stuff and where you can defend yourselves. So that's the scale of the breakdown, in a sense.
That must have been terrible conflict, because people left the cities and re-establishing territories.
Well, it wasn't quite as bad as it would be these days, because actually, the, you know, the population was, of course, much smaller, and there was much more people running away from the people that were the conflict. So there's not really, the Romano British aren't really getting into conflict with each other, because they're all running away from the Saxons who are coming to kill them and steal all their stuff.
Right.
You know, so it isn't that they're in conflict with each other. It's not like civil breakdown would be today. This is like in the, you've got to imagine, you know, it's a much more sparsely populated world, much more fragmented world. Distance means a lot more then than it does now, because, you know, so you have to think about walking and horse riding, so things feel much further away. The world's a much bigger place. But what there are these marauding gangs of Saxons coming to kind of, and so you run away from that. Once you hear about that, you run away from it. If you can't carry your treasures with you, you bury them in the ground and you hope you'll come back from them, back and get them later on. Of course, mostly it never does. Well, we discover the hordes later on, because actually they never do. Either they die or they find a life somewhere else. A lot of people go to live in Brittany. So lesser Britain, because remember the way again, we have to remember geography here as well, is that there aren't roads, there are tracks, and the Severn is incredibly difficult because the tides of the Severn's very difficult to get across. And so what people often did was they take boats across to Ireland and in particular to Brittany. Or to Cornwall and back of it. So there's a lot of destruction and flight and breakdown.
Some of the interesting DNA stuff that's coming out more recently is kind of showing that the basic sort of people who were the people on the ground, if you like, stayed there.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was more like the cultural over. It's been like the Romano British took on the people that were there took on that Roman overlay.
Yeah.
It's almost more like the Saxons coming in took over big areas of land, but the people that were there often were just told to get on with it by the new Saxon overlords. So the DNA elements, apart from little bits of like Orkney and there's bits in sort of Lincolnshire, I think, and East Anglia that have got Viking DNA.
Yeah.
It looks like it's hardly changed really since the Bronze Age.
No, that's right, but that's exactly right. Because of course it's the shift of culture, because those people who are have the possessions, have the learning, have the understanding. That's the interesting thing about the idea of Walcott. So what happens because there are Walcotts over the country? So a lot of the Welsh stay, but they're then part of the new structure, which is why they end up in the Walcott in the Welsh ghetto, because they're now working for they're now the Saxon overlords, Saxon thanes that take control of that. And then of course when the Normans come in later on, that equally happens to the Saxons. I mean, that's the and of course you got this strange thing with, you know, the Normans coming in. the Normans believe that they are the true Britons who are coming in to restore true British sovereignty, because they've come out of Normandy, Brittany, where a lot of British refugees went, you know. And so there is that kind of myth of exile and return that actually that people like William Duke of Normandy uses as a sort of a rationale for his rightful kingship of Britain. You know, but you're right, of course, that on top of this, there's a, the population remains stable. What doesn't remain stable is the culture. And so what happens is Christianity is driven, if you like, into the hinterlands, as the sort of old Saxon gods are kind of become, you know, the dominant class, because that's the dominant, you know, they are the dominant cultural force. Except in places like Wales and aspects of Cornwall and up in the north and kind of aspects of Northumbria as well, where the Brythonic traditions remain. But it's what you see happening around the Welsh traditions at this time is this, and this is what the thing you find in the medieval traditions around Arthur, around this king who will come, the sense of the king who is continually coming and will put things right. And you know, we get the vision of Merlin, which has the sense of the red dragon arising and driving the white dragon to the side of the pool and re-establishing the ancient harmony of things. Now this becomes a mythical kind of substrate, really, which partly is based upon the political realities of the time, but also is based on something much deeper. That's based upon the idea of, from the place of confusion and difficulty, we create the possibility of harmony and communion, and that quality the Egyptians called mart, that sense of justice. And so when we come back to this kind of path between Keter and Tiferet, we're really looking at that non-dual energy coming down into the heart in Tiferet and creating this dynamic kind of balance. But it adds to the quality. So Tiferet and the middle triangle has a sense of things in harmony, things in balance. But what comes in with the energy of Keter is this very deep rootedness and this sense of everything in union. Opposites in union as opposed to opposites working in harmony. So this massively deepens that healing capacity of Tiferet. You know, Tiferet is backed then somewhere by this deep sense of the non-duality of everything.
Can I ask, is the in getting away from a linear way of looking at things, is the expression mythopoetic? It seems very useful to me in this context, because it is about making relationship and story with the whole of a sentient universe, isn't it?
It is, and it's like all things, we have to hold these things in a particular way. Because there's a way in which, particularly because of the culture we have, where mythopoetic can be seen as not very substantial, can be seen as an interesting way to look at something. And it's partly to do with how poetry, you know, poetry is regarded as a cultural extra. And if we go back to the attitudes that the Celts had to the bards, these are the speakers of truth who can destroy a person's life, who can bring boils to a person by saying a verse against them. So there is an understanding, if you like, that the Celts had about the power of creativity, about the power of the imagination, that we have now lost. And so both that sense of myth and poetry that's there in mythopoetic is, you know, we're speaking of something as tangible as the climate, about whether it's going to rain or not. You know, so the speaking of a verse, the speaking of a poem, is direct as the passing of a law. And in a sense, when we can kind of understand that possibility, we can't really, you know, we can try to, but we're brought up in a completely different culture where to equate the passing of a law with the speaking of a poem, we might like, I would like that I could feel that as being equivalent. But if I'm honest with you, I can't, actually. I mean, I feel the difference of it because I'm affected by the culture that I'm brought up in. You know, if I think of what Christopher Okigbo has done with that one poem, let alone his other few poems, you know, he's done something with his life, you know, a very short life, but he has done something that immortalizes his life and immortalizes his culture and is an access point, not just for his culture, but for anybody else who wants to connect the deep roots of their culture with the surface of their culture. You know, in that poem, he shows us how to do it. Yeah, and he takes us into the mystery of Mother Edito and the white moonlit mermaid of the shining sea. Right, so he takes us into that mystery, shares us, he initiates us in a certain sense into that mystery, and shows us how we can do it for ourselves. Now, that is, in a sense, I would say, more substantial than the passing of a law which can be repealed later on. But I understand that, and I think that to be true, but do I feel that in my bones? Well, I don't think I do. I would like, increasingly I can do that, but not really, because of the way in which the imagination has been placed in a very particular category through our culture. Because, you see, if we take seriously the power of our imagination, we then have to consider how powerful we are as beings. And therefore, we are never powerless. What we imagine can come into being if we hold the imagination in a particular way.
The point is the response to a poem or something, that's all individualized, obviously, and deep, whereas the passing of a law is not embodied at all. It's just a surface rule that we have to obey because it's in our best interest to, you know. And you get this every time you get a new law. I remember about every time they change the drinking and driving laws or this sort of thing, you know, you get battalions of crusty old buffers who really were dragged kicking and screaming, you know, and people today who don't think it's important but they obey the law because they have to. That's a completely different thing. Laws don't have only the power to compel by restricting your freedom or fining you or something. But I suppose they're a way of making us all socialised.
Well, they are. But also, poetry is not just subjective. The idea that poetry is individualised is a relatively modern idea. The bardic way of poetry has a meaning, has an intention, and the intention speaks. So so the more modern idea that I take from whatever I want from it. Is actually quite alien to that ancient bardic idea. You know, Taliesin's intention in Prithayanavin, of course we all will draw all kinds of stuff from that, but his intention is to transmit a tradition. And that is as substantial, that's what I mean about that being as substantial as a law. So the law says you shall do this. The poem says you will experience this. our interpretation of it we may not understand, because we are not Taliesin, we don't have the vision of Taliesin. We may not understand that poem, and so our rendition of the poem may be faulty. Our understanding of the poem may be very faulty. But the, you know, in a certain sense, when we're recovering a tradition in this way, one of the particular problems we live in neo-paganism somewhere is that everybody does think they can make it up as they go along, and however they think it is, therefore it is. So, you know, henceforth you get these ideas of people who claim these family traditions have gone back for hundreds and hundreds of years, which are just total nonsense. There's no such thing as a tradition has done that. And if it had done that, it would be this weird, introverted, isolated, out of relationship thing. The whole point about these mythic poetic traditions is that they evolve and develop and grow with the needs of the community and the needs of the time. And one of the things that does happen, and it certainly has happened at the moment, is at a certain point you have to return to the beginnings of a tradition to discover, well, what's got lost here, what is no longer understood. You know, because one of the things, if we like, we think of the Arthurian tradition for a moment and how that develops, so how it develops from the Norman period onward, really, it become, and Geoffrey of Monmouth is key in this. So Geoffrey of Monmouth is a very interesting kind of nodal figure, really, because actually in his History of the Kings of Britain and in his Vita Millini, he includes all kinds of very ancient, powerful ideas that come out of very early Welsh tradition. But of course, it's written for the Norman aristocracy. The Vita Millini, Vita in particular, has, you know, you're given, I suppose, the vision for both the Merlin documents, actually, have all these very powerful ancient images in them. You know, that some of them are, some which are obvious, some which are not at all obvious. And yet it's written in such a way to Robert, the Bishop of Gloucester, the Duke, the Earl Bishop of Gloucester, and it's written to flatter the Norman overlords and to say, you are the true heirs to the Britons, and therefore you are wholly legitimate. And it starts off a whole kind of literature where this becomes the literature of the rulers. It's about the kings and the queens and the that continues. You find, you find Tennyson, for example, as poet laureate, writing the idylls of the king and kind of in a way that supports his understanding of what the British Empire was. Now, that, in a way, comes to an end, really, with people like Tennyson. There's some Mallory's also, you know, Mallory's the great synthesizer of all of that, and people riff off him. So, but that comes to an end, in a certain sense, with Tennyson. And one of the things you start to see happening in the 20th century is a reinvention of the Arthurian myth, and in particular, if we look at the poets David Jones and Charles Williams, then something really different starts to happen there. Both of whom go back to an earlier ideas of the Arthurian myth. David Jones's case, of course, he's been through the First World War as a private soldier, and has really experienced the awfulness of the British Empire, And so he spends all his life really writing his works that are a synthesis of Christianity and early Welsh tradition, and applying themselves to his experience of having gone through the First World War and the experience of being alive here and now. Charles Williams does something different, really. Now, Charles Williams doesn't go to war, you know, but he is a working class person, you know, when people talk about the Inklings and Charles Williams as being part of them, but he's kind of the outsider of Inklings because he didn't go to university. he worked in a publishing house, and he comes from a working class family in London. And he has this, but he has this very profound kind of mystical kind of vision of the Arthurian stories about the, and this idea of the, well, actually, he develops an alternative idea of empire, which is not the imperial British Empire, but is the something he calls the web of exchange, which is this place of total kind of dialogue, which is the place that we're touching into when we talk in, when we talk about this path and we talk about the opposites in union. And so what he does is give us a description, really. I'll just read you a little bit of his vision of empire. Now, he has this image of the empire for him is rooted in Byzantium, in now Istanbul, Constantinople. But it's an image of it's not a literal thing, it's an image of a different kind of empire. The organic bodies sang together. Dialects of the world sprang in Byzantium. Back they rang to sing in Byzantium. The streets repeat the sound of the throne. Now, the throne is the divine throne. It's the place of the supernals. The acts issue from the throne. So this is like the impulses arising out of the supernal triangle. The acts issue from the throne. Under it, translating the Greek minusculi to minds of the tribes, the identities of creation phenomenally abating to kinds and kindred. So this is the idea of these things being translated. So he's got into the idea of, like, the Greek was the language of Byzantium, but as it passes from that place of the unity, it is translated into local dialects, just as the impulses that arise out of the supernal triangle are translated into things that make sense at the level at which we meet them. The household inscribes the acts of the emperor. The logothetes, these are the messengers of the emperor, the logothetes run down the porphyry stair, bearing the missives through the area of empire. Taliesin walked through the hither angels, from the exposition of grace to the place of images. So the exposition of grace would be Dart, that's the appearance of, and in Yesod we find the place of images. The morn brightened on the golden horn. He heard behind him the chariots clatter that bore a new matter to all the dialects. So this is the idea of something new arising, a process arising and moving through us into the world. Or he saw the nuntai. These are the nuntai are the messengers, the papal messengers. The nuntai loosened on all the currents over the seas in the mechanism of motion. Rowers' arms jointed to the imperial oars. Chariots and galleys sprang from the shores. The messengers were born over sea and land. So this is this impulse arising from the deep place in us, being transmitted through the Sephirot, transmitted into life, into the world. And he's using the image of the boats coming out from Byzantium. So the messengers going out from there, the acts of the throne. The king's poet gazed in the mirror of the horn. So this is their sense of looking into the mystery, looking in through the eye of the imagination, contemplating. And he's using the image of the golden horn, which is the kind of, if like that, the sea harbour of Byzantium. And then he tells us what he sees. He's now seeing the vision of empire. The morning rose on the golden horn. I saw the identities imaged in a sapphire sea. Beyond Sinai, Ararat. Beyond Ararat, Elburz. Light sprinkling, flaked snow sparkling. Chastities of ranged peaks of Caucasus. Snows glow on the world's brows. Charged, changed with deep veils of verdure, deep green veils. The misses of identity come from the scribes, where the tribes gather and keep holiday on the name day and the birthday of their father, the emperor. The empire's sun shone on each round mound. Double fortresses defending dales of fertility. The bright blades shone in the craft of the dancing war. The stripped maids laughed for the joy of the province, bearing in themselves the shape of the province, founded in the base of space, in the rounded bottom of the emperor's glory. Spines were strengthened, love settled, tossed through aerial gulfs of empire. The lost name, the fool's shame, fame and frame of lovers in lowlands of Caucasia, rang around snowy Elbers. The organic body sang together. Elbers rose in the golden horn, south from the seabone Thule, the skull stone, the herbage of lone rock, the scheme of Logres, the theme of the design of the empire. Rose in balance and weight, freight of government with glory. Merlin, time's meter, climbs through prisms and lines, over near Camelot and far Carbonek, over the perilous sea, the sea of union. The phosphor of Percival's philosophical star shines. Lancelot's lion, bewildered by the smell of adoration, roars around Guinevere's lordly body. Merlin defines in blazons of the brain, shield upon shield, station upon station, and the road resounds with the galloping lords. The sword flashed, the pirates fly. The table stands rigid in the king's hall, and over their seats the plotted arms of the soul, which are their feet and the whole history of Logres. Down the imperial high road the white Nuntius rides to heighten the hearts of Lateran, Gaul and Logres. Poem goes on. But what is being described there is an image of empire, an image of possibilities, really, where everything is in communion. And what you see in that poem, Charles William showing us, the acts arising out of the mysterious place, out of the supernals, and becoming translated and transmitted as they emerge from the deep place to the surface. And one of the key places is this place, the contemplating the place of images, which for us is Yersant. And what Taliesin, the poet, shows us the ability to contemplate images and to work with images as icons. So what he sees as he looks into the place of images is the organic body of the world. And we have the whole complex symbolism that the Williams uses that I won't go into now, where we're given the sense of the of Sinai, the place of revelation. We're given the sense of Ararat, which is Noah's Ark, and the sense of the before Sinai. And we're given the sense of Caucasia, which in Williams' philosophy is the place of matter, of flesh, or of the roundedness of flesh. And so he shows us this appearance of flesh and matter, and then he shows us then that there is this scheme called Logres, which is this image really of the, which is, he takes the Arthurian myth and he takes it into this much more spiritualized image of a deep unfolding pattern that's emerging out of the deepest places in us. And then we get to see the images of the knights and the table as representing not anything tribal at all, but as an archetypal pattern that enables a new vision of the world to come into being.
I've got to say that without your commentary, that would all have been totally opaque to me.
Yeah.
Now, if I'd been reading it for myself, so I could look at it and study the words, I might have got something else. But, I mean, really, it seems there are so many specific allusions in these poems.
Yeah.
They're really very difficult to fathom. And I think I'd feel the same with David Jones as well.
Well, the thing is, and this is true of the early Welsh bards as well, right, this is where we have lost the understanding of poetry. And it's the place where we think of poetry as something that should simply create an emotional reaction in us. And it's the place of the performance poet doing their rant. They don't mind them, they don't mind performance, they think it's fun. But actually it's different from the deep roots of poetry, where a poem is a maze. A poem is a labyrinth that you engage with, that you meditate on, that you research, that you engage with, that opens a different reality for you. And in a sense, both David Jones and Charles Williams are completely in the lineage of Taliesin when they write their poetry. But this is one of the, you know, this is one of my real concerns about modern life and modern poetry, the idea that everything, first of all, that everything has to create emotional feeling, not spiritual feeling or intellectual, there has to be like an emotional response, or else it's not worth bothering with. Mm. And secondly, the idea that things that complex things should be immediately accessible. You know, that actually there is value. And in a sense, in the older world, you take a poem or a biblical verse and you work with its opaqueness. You know, it engages your heart, it engages your mind, and as a result, you discover the meaning. Is that image really of a meaning being like, from being like a nut, where you have to crack the shell of the nut, you have to find the sweetness inside it, and that means you have to taste the bitterness of the shell and find a way to get past that, and in a certain sense you almost have to grow your teeth really, so your teeth are strong enough to crack the nut, and that's. It's actually quite an important point. This is one of the, and it's true of when you look at most of the older mythical kind of literature, it's very obscure, and you need to work on it. And in a sense, part of the whole thing that drives me a bit mad about a lot of the neo-pagan stuff is that is people just taking surface meanings, surface feelings, and just running with that. And then they completely miss the deeper intention of the tradition somewhere.
It's interesting that what you've been talking about is really, correlates really to that lightning meditation we did, where for me the key was the warrior who wouldn't speak, which was the key to the Prido Anun. And anyone in our group who didn't know the Prido Anun got a really useful and relevant set of images that they could interpret, but somehow getting the key to it made us feel that we understood the maze we were in, the labyrinth we were in. Even though I still haven't a clue really what the deeper meaning of the Prido Anun is, you know, because that's a thing for constant study. But knowing, at least knowing the format of it, gave us the key to that meditation.
No, I think that's right, and that's part of what exactly. So you know, you'd have an experience, you know, you don't know Prithayanun, but to know that the structure of Prithayanun and to have a sense of your relationship with that gives an extra dimension to it. And similarly with this kind of difficult poems like Charles Williams or David Jones, to understand it and to know that it's difficult, but not to be put off by the difficulty of it, enables you to discover a way of thinking and being that used to be central to both the spirituality and to the practice of poetry, where you're looking not at subjective feeling, but you're looking at something deeper. You're going beyond Hod and Netzach into the experience of Tiferet, and beyond Tiferet into the art. You know, so that's the in a sense, when Charles Williams is talking about the act issuing from the throne, the logothetes running down the porphyry stair, Now there's symbolism in all of that, right? There's all kind of detail about the fact that it's the stairs of porphyry, and the idea of the logothetes. They bear the word, they bear the living word. And porphyry is the royal stone. It's a very hard purple stone. It's very special. The porphyry stair. You're touching something that's really right at the apex of things. That stone was only used in very. So telling these are very special stairs, not any old stairs. You know, so there's layers upon layers of symbolism here somewhere, which. And it's not about having to accumulate lots of knowledge necessarily, but it is about being able to think and to inquire in a particular way.
And one last point about it, because, like I say, it would have been good for me to have looked at that. But, of course, this is an oral tradition, isn't it? So when you're... And these poems are meant to be recited. Ancient poems are meant to be recited. Yep. So actually, when you do this for us or to us, you're actually engaging the same ancient oral tradition that...
Yes, it's true. And it's absolutely true of both Williams and Jones's poetry that the best thing to do if you're going to read it is read it aloud to yourself. And certainly a group of us reading it to each other or listening to each other, you hear, you know, again, it's confluence and conversation. It is dialogue that enables then something different to emerge. And in a way, that this all is very relevant to this particular path, because in order to... just stay in the middle of this path, you have to be able to deal with mystery and frustration and not understanding and not knowing, but allowing something to move through us and allowing ourselves to be directed in a certain sense, allowing, you know, when the logothetes descend from the throne, you don't say, and you don't ask them to go back and get it better and get it written up in an easier way. Why do you receive the message? And then it's for you to make sense of the message. Because in a certain sense, if we consider this presence of Tiferet, of Keter, of coming down into Tiferet, it disturbs the world, it shakes the world, it connects the relatively stable world of the middle triangle with something much more surreal, much more it's not at all chaotic, but it appears chaotic because it disrupts the known. And the whole temptation, if you like, between the art and the abyss is to decide to do without the supernal triangle, to become, to make Dart the known, to make that sense of Dart as knowledge, as the crown of the tree. Right, and that's when we fall into the abyss, because that's when we enter into, when we refuse that deeper unity, we refuse the organic unity, and we enter into that place of division and separation, because we encapsulate ourselves in our knowing.
Can you give us an example of that, just to make it clear?
Well, an example of that would be to try and an example of that is to, instead of being with the mystery of that meditation, those images, would be to decide, well, I know what that's about. Mm. Or equally, well, that's all a lot of rubbish. It's silly rubbish. Okay, and I think poetry is rubbish. You know, poetry is all right if it's a good social, fulfilling a nice social purpose, nice rant, that's lovely. But I want poetry to be simple. Poetry should be simple. So any poetry that isn't simple is not worth publishing. Poetry should touch your heart. Shouldn't have to think about it. Right? It's anything like that, right? Anything like that, that actually, instead of taking us into mystery, becomes a kind of a capping statement, right? That says that, so any belief that I hold really strongly that's not susceptible to inquiry takes us into the abyss.
So those things that you were talking about just now, about virtue should be the set and the other, are you saying that's a da'at, a shadow of da'at?
Well, it's a piece of knowledge, right? So that's what I believe, so therefore it stops the inquiry. The whole point of what happens in da'at is a continual inquiry and deconstruction. So any statement that stops inquiry, because I know, I don't need to inquire now because I know, it become, and that then we have as the crown of our tree. It stops the further. It stops the deconstructive deepening.
Okay, and the abyss then is. I'm just trying to get those two sorted in my mind. That's why I'm asking. Because the abyss is the shadow stuff of our.
Well, the abyss is then that because we're not. The abyss exists because we're not connecting to the supernals. We're not connecting to the non-dual place. So what we have, so if you like, the supernals is the root place. So at our root, we then have a set of beliefs. I know who I am, and I know what I believe, and I know what I like, and I know what I think. Right? And that's it. Right? So further deconstruction is not possible. So that means the da'at, instead of being the knowing of not knowing, has become simple knowing, because I know. And once I know, I have no, and I'm clear that I know, I don't have any impulse to inquire and deconstruct my knowing. Mm-hmm. And that, you know, that is true of all our beliefs, right? The whole point about da'at, it's profoundly, it just deconstructs everything we think we know. Because everything we think we know is partial. Not even saying it's wrong, but it is partial. So the thing that we think we know that is kind of helpful to know, at the next level up, becomes a complete impediment. I mean, that's the whole point about in the Prithayanavin, that the sentinel who won't, we return each time to the sentinel who won't answer us, until we find the next deeper level of understanding. So we think we know, we expect to get passed through the door, and we're not, because actually our understanding is partial. And so that understanding has to die in order for something new to emerge.
If we, when we're both listening to poetry or reading poetry, and also making our own art in any way, whether it's painting or writing or whatever, moving maybe, there's something about like really free associating, letting whatever come. Are we sort of in the territory that's intended in the poetry, in the ancient mythic poetry, to sort of rather than thinking, oh, this is about this, by sort of getting into that kind of free associative place, whatever, even if the images seem completely mad and incongruent, you're sort of allowing. Eventually something gets revealed, doesn't it, when you just allow the seeming randomness.
Well, it can do, but and that can work, and that's an important place in that. But it's not the end of the whole thing, because actually, with most poems is an intention. So the randomness, what the randomness does is to free us up to catch the intention, to catch the hint that the poet or the artist is intending, and the. You know, for example, you know, the Prithayanavin could take us in all kinds of directions that would be creative and interesting and does do. But its root intention is to teach us something about the freeing of the prisoner. So we can randomly get all kinds of good things from that poem and not get the freeing of the prisoner. And so our understanding would be partial. Because actually, if we really listen to the deep structure of that poem, it takes us to that place.
I suppose that would be, if you just took it, the free association to as the only level. But I'm thinking about how sometimes when, well, this happens to me anyway, like I intend to write about a poem or something about something, and then as I'm writing it, something else happens.
Yeah, but that's because your deeper intention as the author of the poem. So with the surface of your mind, you have an idea, you're caught by something, you think you're writing about something. As you write it, that deeper intention from the supernal starts to kick in and something else emerges. And the something else is the core of the poem. It's what's expressing itself. Now you're caught by something initially, but of course your own knowing, even of the poem you're writing, is partial, because as you engage with it, you touch then the deeper impulse that then expresses itself as it needs to express itself. So that free association place is really kind of important, because it loosens us up and makes us available to that. But then, of course, as you know, the other thing you have to do in writing a poem, or in writing any piece of work, is then to redefine the form, to write the shape, the poem or the piece of writing in such a way that it adequately expresses the underneath intention. The words have to feel right, they have to weigh right against each other. They have to balance each other, right? So that's the other side of the kind of free association. That's then the focusing down and the crafting of the shape, so that the shape expresses the underneath intention.
Is there something about the way that we work with poetry and the way that we relate with poetry that then teaches us something about how to relate to what we encounter in life and how to experience that in some way?
No, I think that's absolutely true. I think that's, you know, that whole business of, we just think of that whole practice of the frustration of working like with a difficult poem, for example, and the understanding of that. It teaches us an awful lot about how to work with the difficult areas of life, I think, and the kind of, and certainly the sense of the working, understanding things that are underneath the surface rather than just being on the surface is something that's really important these days, because where so much of life is lived on the surface, I think. And then when we're working with poetry that is specifically relating to the deeper places of the soul and the deeper places of our culture, well then, you know, it's, you know, one of my interests is, I've got a real interest in current politics, but my mythopoetic work, if you like, completely informs my way of understanding the things that are underneath the things that are currently happening. You know, and so absolutely, I think that's why, you know, that's why I think that the stuff is poetry and mythical stuff is actually it's for me primary material, because it's nearer the source of things that then help us understand the working out of things. And in a way, it's kind
it's
of
like uncertainty, isn't it, and complexity.
Yeah, totally. You put that really nicely, because that's exactly it. Working with uncertainty and complexity is what we most need to understand to work with in the world at the moment, and it's the thing that people don't want to do. And you know, there's something, as we wrestle with these poems and start to understand them, it really teaches us a lot about that, the process of understanding itself, I think, really. You know, I think it's really important.
Strikes me is it's never ending. So, you know, you could be really good at interpreting and understanding a poem and getting to the very basis of it, but it's only that experience that thinks it's got to the end of it. Yeah. Whereas there might be much more. And I'm thinking about people who are mediums or belief in afterlives, where does it stop? It doesn't stop, does it?
No, it doesn't stop. No, I think it just, like, you know, there's always a new edge, right? There's all, when that's part of the infinite creativity of things, there's always a new edge. So once we know something, then we're up against the next bit of unknowing. My teacher, Ernest Butler, used to say, used to do this great imagery that, where he said, no matter how wide your circle of light, in fact, the wider your circle of light, the wider the bigger the darkness around you. So always there's that edge place where we're pressing into the unknown, pressing into what the next thing. And I think that's the exciting aspect of things, really, actually, because wouldn't it be so dull to know everything and to have no challenges, to have no unknown to work with? It would be horrible. It'd be like being in prison. You know, so that's the genuinely exciting edge here, Jenny, I think, really.
But we constantly want to know, so it's that paradox, isn't it?
Yeah, totally, yeah. But that's the motivation almost, right? So that it is a paradox. So it's knowing and not knowing, and that's that edge place. So being on that edge. So this is that edge of the art, right? This is this place. Right, where you're with knowing and not knowing and kind of and working with the contradictions of that somewhere.
Because I was thinking, if we haven't studied that poem, in a way I was thinking, well, we don't understand as much, but then that could be an advantage, because then we're just coming to it fresh. So...
Well, yes and no. Yes, so of course you could. You'd have a different experience. It is in this particular instance, it is an advantage of studying the poem, because the poem...
Some of you have done it for 2 years, whatever, studied the poem, and some of us haven't.
Yeah.
And
that's the nice thing then about having a mixed group of people looking at the poem, is that there's freshness and experience. So that's part of it, right? That's part of the mix somewhere. Yeah.
What you were saying about what a horrible world it would be to live in if we didn't have that sense of mystery and inquiry and everything reminds me that the cad of the film world, George Saunders, committed suicide when he was 60, and he said he was going to, and he said, that's it, I've done everything, you know, there's nothing to look for, you know, there was nothing else for him, you know, and without that sense of mystery and inquiry and fascination with the world, he was quite right, you know, material he could possibly want, you know, and reputation, and he didn't have to do it, all he had to do was coast on his reputation until he lived to a ripe old age, but life seemed insupportable because obviously he didn't have that faculty.
No, he didn't have the capacity to look beyond that, I guess, really. And then, of course, he's entirely right. Then it would be, if life is just a repetition, then of course it's awful, you know. So yeah. Okay, let's have a break for tea break and come back at 4 o'clock. And we will. Try and bring this all together.